You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear from a Wisconsin photographer who's putting some of the state's most iconic natural places into Google Maps Street View.
First, new bipartisan legislation being proposed in Wisconsin would require juvenile corrections officers to report evidence of child abuse. This new mandatory reporting bill comes after allegations of abuse at the Lincoln Hill School for Boys and the Copper Lake School for Girls.
One of the bill's authors, State Representative Joel Clayfish, is also working on what's been called a right to try bill, which would potentially allow patients access to certain experimental medications. Those laws are already on the books in 33 other states, and others are considering them.
Joel Clayfish joins us now to talk about these bills and more. He's a Republican state representative from Oconomowoc. Representative Clayfish, thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Along with Democratic Senator LaTanya Johnson of Milwaukee, you're putting forward legislation that would require juvenile corrections officers to report child abuse when they see it. Why specifically do you think that this is needed?
Well, I'll tell you, anybody who is taking care of children under any circumstances should be a mandatory reporter for child abuse. Whether it's a child at school or in a daycare, or a child who we want to have a real chance at rehabilitation and reentering society, along the way, we should have safeguards in place to make sure if that child is being abused that it gets reported. No child, whether they're in school or whether they're in the criminal justice system, is worth any less. And the reality of it is, I think Senator Johnson and I were surprised that there was a contingent of people who work very closely with children who are not mandatory reporters. And when we saw that, we thought the best solution to that would be that just to add them to the list of mandatory reporters.
Do you see this bill as being related to the allegations of abuse at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake School for Youth?
I can tell you that this was not a response to what is being investigated at Lincoln Hills, but I can tell you this was a response to learning that people who were in charge of juveniles at correctional facilities were not mandatory reporters, which did come from that information. Look, the reality is when you are working with the criminal justice system, you have to be okay with saying, okay, here are mistakes and here are ways in which we can make them better. So I wouldn't say it was in response to what happened there, but it was in response to our surprise that people who take care of children under any circumstance in the state of Wisconsin are not mandatory reporters.
You said surprise, so why do you think that this was not a requirement on the books already?
I think there are many laws that are on the books that have small glitches or loopholes that you don't learn about until after implementation. If we were all telepathic, we would have the answers before the bills were published and practiced. But as human beings, we write the legislation the best we can, and if there are holes in it that need to be addressed, we do our very best to address them.
What kind of consequences would there be for someone who was discovered not to be reporting abuse that they'd seen?
This would be the same consequences that are in place right now for mandatory reporters in other situations, which I believe is up to a $10,000 fine and 1 year in jail. So this does actually have teeth to it. We're saying if a child is in your stead, if a child is in your care, it is incumbent upon you to report abuse if you see it. And I think that in order to make sure that it happens under all circumstances, when you put a criminal penalty attached to it that's got some teeth, some potential jail time, and pocketbook, when you affect the pocketbook, you're giving a real deterrent to ignore the law that's in place. So we want to make sure that anybody who's taking care of children, and whether those children are straight-A students or they have made a grievous error in their life with the hopes of becoming, productive members of society, that we know if they are in an abusive situation that someone's going to find out so it can stop and that child can be helped, regardless their station at that point.
Do you think once that aspect of it is taken care of, the reporting, do you think that the necessary mechanisms are in place that there will be a swift response?
Well, I only hope so. I mean, you'd have to take a look at the way mandatory cases are reported at, right now. But nobody in their right mind wants a child who's being abused not to be able to put an end to that abuse. And the first way you do that is for authorities or other people to know about that abuse. So when you tell a profession that the children under your care are important enough that if you see them being abused, you have to tell somebody. I mean, it sends a signal across across the board that we care about the welfare of our kids.
Now, this is a rare instance of a bipartisan bill. Where else do you see room to work with Democrats in the near future?
It's not a rare instance. Unfortunately, we get that question quite a bit. And if you'd have taken a close look at the bills I had signed into law, I had more than 20 bills signed into law last session. Every single one of them was co-authored by a Democrat, and 16 of them were co-lead authored by Democrats. So for me and for my record, it is not a rare instance that I'm co-authoring a bill with a Democrat. In fact, LaTanya Johnson, when she was in the Assembly, co-authored several bills on adoption reform that were signed into law last session. So this is nothing new for me. I'm not a strict partisan. I think that the best work is often done when you can look to others who may have a different philosophy than you and come up with the best ideas through compromise. And that is something that I have always done and will continue to do.
And you've said, you made the case that this is not unusual for you, but what about your GOP colleagues? Do you think that you're seeing the same willingness to work across the aisle?
I think you're going to see the vast majority of bills that pass this legislature in this legislative session, as they were last session, co-authored by Republicans and Democrats. There are always some contentious issues that tend to get more attention because that's the news value. One of the seven tenets of news value is conflict. So when you have conflict, very often you will see more partisan issues, which are philosophical divides between the right and the left. But the vast majority of things that are done to make this a better place for the citizens who live here take compromise. And the legislators who are the least egotistical and narcissistic are the ones who are willing to say, I'm not always right. And I will tell you, I'm not always right. And I have no problem going across the aisle and asking someone from a certain area of the state, someone with a different experience and background, for their advice on which way they think something should go. I've never been afraid of it, and I've never been afraid to say I'm wrong when something doesn't go the way we anticipated.
We're talking right now with Republican Representative Joel Clayfish, talking about a couple pieces of legislation that he's working on, including one, a bipartisan bill that would require juvenile corrections officers to report evidence of child abuse. And I want to talk about a different bill right now. This is one you're working with a GOP colleague on, Representative Pat Snyder, on the so-called right to try legislation. Why do you think that this is needed?
Well, and first off, I want to give some credit to Diane Hesselbein, who's a Democrat, whose idea this was originally a couple sessions ago. I think this is needed because I don't think it's government's place to tell somebody who has been given a death sentence by their doctor that they may not try any means necessary to try to prolong their life and survive. Representative Hesselbein and I have been talking about this for a couple years already. The new Representative Snyder is on board, and we are working together across the aisles to say, if you have a terminal illness and you want to try anything possible to save your own life, you should have the right to do it, as long as that doesn't infringe on the rights or the health of others.
And the FDA, it has an expanded access option already in place, which has a high approval rating for this kind of thing. Why isn't that enough?
Well, I think that, the FDA may have those abilities in place, but the state, unless the state codifies what they have in place, then it's not able to be tried here. And 33 states allow a right to try medications, and it's about time Wisconsin become one of the 34 who does.
President Trump was scheduled to visit Milwaukee on Thursday. He was going to be taking a tour of the Harley-Davidson plant, and that visit was canceled. In part, I don't know all the inner workings, but in part because Harley-Davidson was uneasy about possible protests. What do you think about the company's uneasiness and the subsequent decision to cancel?
Boy, you really sprung that one on me, huh? But I would say that Harley-Davidson is one of the prides of Milwaukee, and they're a private entity, and they should be able to decide what whatever they think is best for their company and their employees on their own.
Representative Clayfish, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, my pleasure.
Joel Clayfish is a Republican state representative from Oconomowoc. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll hear from the photographer who put Devil's Lake on the map, well, at least on the Google map, as you can now take a virtual tour of the park through Street View.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Gwen Gillen now calls Madison home, but her roots are in the South, where she fought for civil rights. Jeff Burkhardt brings us her story.
Civil rights leader Stokely Carmichael called her a gutsy little sister. At 17, Gwen Gillen became the youngest staff member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Now, the retired teacher calls Madison home, but she grew up in Anniston, Alabama, one of seven children.
My first memory is that three-room shack, and oftentimes when you see old movies of the South and the slave huts, you see these three-room shacks where we didn't have electricity, we had candle lights at night, and there was no refrigerator, and the ice man used to come around. So we pretty much had the same meal every day until I graduated from high school. We had beans and cornbread.
Later, they moved to Bear Mash at the foot of the Appalachians, where they picked plums and blueberries, and they had electricity and running water. Gwen's mother was one of the people who petitioned the local government for it.
She worked as a maid, but she insisted that we go to school every day. You couldn't make the law C. She wanted a B or an A. During my senior year, I got chosen for a full scholarship to go to Tougaloo College in Tougaloo, Mississippi.
It was there at Tougaloo College in 1963 that she met members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
When I got to Tougaloo, I met the civil rights people, and I asked them, well, how can I be a part of the movement? And they said, well, you can join us. And so I dropped out of Tougaloo College in about 2 weeks after being there and joined the civil rights movement and became a staff member of SNCC.
Gwen later went to Oberlin College in preparation for the Freedom Summer of 1964.
We weren't making any progress, so to speak, just sitting in at lunch counters and stuff like that. So we thought the best thing to do was to register people to vote.
On the first day of Freedom Summer, June 21st, 1964, three young civil rights workers were murdered. They, like Gwen, had been registering black voters in Mississippi. The men were arrested by the police on trumped-up charges and then released after dark into the hands of the Ku Klux Klan.
We went hunting for them in Neshoba County, and we would go in at night in black clothing and walk around the bushes and stuff and see if we could find them. I think they found them about a week or two later. It was frightening, but we had to do something.
Gwen continued to work for SNCC for the next 2 years. Then in 1966, she was offered a scholarship to the UW-Madison.
And I personally wanted to understand American history. I was a person and an American, and I didn't feel I should be treated any different than anybody else. And I just couldn't understand why they did that.
She studied American history as she planned and eventually got a degree in special education. She continued to be active in the civil rights movement on campus and in Milwaukee. Gwen's time fighting for civil rights in Alabama, Mississippi, and Wisconsin helped her understand herself and the importance of political participation.
I learned that you should vote every time. I think that voting matters.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, if you've ever wanted to visit Devil's Lake State Park, but you haven't been able to, you have another option, courtesy of our next guest, a virtual tour of the park using Street View from Google Maps.
Using a special camera on loan from Google, photographer Christopher Pitts was recently able to capture images as he hiked the trails of Devil's Lake. Those images were later stitched together to create 360-degree panoramas that recreate the area in all of its glory, and they're available to view right now on your computer or your smartphone. He's also submitted photos from dells of the Wisconsin River State Natural Area, as well as Cascade Mountain.
Christopher Pitts joins us now to tell us more about these projects. He's a Wisconsin-based photographer and owner and manager of Christopher Pitts Photography, LLC. Christopher, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, first off, can you tell us how you got involved taking these pictures for Google Maps Street View in the first place?
Yeah, photography has always been a passion of mine. Whenever I can find time, I'm always looking for ways to get more involved in photography. I happen to be Google searching just Street View images and 360 photography, and I found the program, and I just thought it would be a fun way to explore new technology while taking photos.
Now, I've been around Devil's Lake up on the bluff trails and things like that. I've been downhill skiing. I've done neither of those things with 50 pounds of camera equipment on me. Can you talk about what it's like to do these things with all this heavy stuff?
Yeah, I tell you what, the first trip I did was to the West Bluff Trail, and it was the first time ever at Devil's Lake I got to the top of the bluffs, and I decided to just keep moving. I didn't want to stay up there for very long, but then over the course of the journey when I was doing it, it became easier and easier.
Why did it get easier? Were you just getting stronger?
Yeah, I think, you know, at first you have the backpack on there, it's pretty tough, and then, you know, after a while your body starts getting used to it.
And now talk about how this works. I, you know, think of taking one still picture, and if it's me, it's a bad picture. How do you take pictures that cover this 360-degree? I mean, you can, when you look online, you could spin around and look up and down and zoom in on the pine needles. How do you capture that?
Yeah, so the camera has a computer system in it, and the camera head has 15 cameras. So every time I'm taking a step, it's taking 15 pictures at the same time. So, you know, over a course of maybe an hour-long hike, it's thousands and thousands of photos that it's capturing.
Wow.
As I walk along the trail.
And then you've got to stitch them all together. Isn't that kind of a monumental task?
Yep, well, they loan out the camera system, and then basically I do the dirty work of hiking and everything, and then everything gets that I captured gets sent back to Google. It's all on hard drives that are in the computer system of the tracker pack. And then they take those hard drives and they stitch everything together from that point on.
As a photographer, what was it like to play with these toys?
I thought it was great. I mean, the minute there was actually a semi-truck that dropped off a pallet of the equipment. you know, I was pretty awestruck at that time and couldn't even fit everything in my car. So, it was almost like Christmas where I was just unpacking everything, and it was a pretty neat experience.
And I'm assuming you've looked at these, checked them out. Does it really feel like being at the park?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty neat. You know, I did it in the fall. The first time I did it, it actually rained, so in the lenses can't get wet. So for the pictures, because otherwise there'd be droplets on it, But yeah, it was a good time.
And this was kind of a labor of love for you, right? You've had a lot of experience hanging out, hiking around at Devil's Lake.
Yeah, I love Devil's Lake, and it was just kind of a fun sabbatical. You know, I did the river, the Wisconsin Dells River, mm-hmm. In Wisconsin Dells, and Devil's Lake and Cascade. I mean, they're all fun things that I enjoyed doing, and I love hiking at Devil's Lake, and I mean, just overall, I thought it would be fun. I generally take pictures of those places anyway, so I thought this was just another challenge and a fun way to just get outdoors and take some photos.
So for anyone who's itching to get outdoors, maybe they can check these out and enjoy them, but are there other practical uses that you think maybe these photographs could be used for?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, for someone that hasn't hiked Devil's Lake, I mean, some of the trails, like the Balance Rock Trail, the Devil's Lake, the West Bluff Trail, I mean, they're difficult, steep climbs where there's stone steps that you're climbing. You know, if someone's just thinking about going, I mean, now they have an opportunity to actually, you know, take a look and see, you know, whether they're up for the challenge of hiking the bluffs.
Now, for the Cascade Mountain one, I imagine, given the expense of this equipment, you did not actually ski down the path, right?
Well, I actually did ski down
You
the
did,
path,
with right? all this gear.
Yep, and I did the easy and the, I guess, the blue and the green courses. I didn't do the black diamond ones because I didn't think I didn't think I could slow down at that point. But anything that seemed realistic, I did.
How would you describe the value of having a record of what these natural areas were like at a certain point in time?
Yeah, I did it like Devil's Lake. I did over the course of late fall and into the wintertime. You know, I'd like to potentially get out there in the summertime as well. But, you know, when talking with Google, they're going to post these, they posted these images now, but, you know, if I go back and do it in the summertime, then people will be able to click on, you know, both the winter or the summer and kind of get different experiences. But yeah, I mean, you're basically, just caught in the moment and you can basically just explore, and I think it's great.
I got to ask, as you're hiking around or walking around, whichever the location is, I imagine this is not a tiny little thing like a GoPro where it's inobtrusive. Did you get a lot of weird looks carrying around this 15-camera rig?
Yeah, I mean, if you follow some of the trails, you can see people that have taken pictures of me or looking. But, I mean, the time I did it was more of an off-season time, so there weren't a lot of people hiking the trails at that time. But yeah, when I was on the ski hill and I was getting off the chairlift and everything, I was getting a lot of questions and people asking me stuff.
Well, sounds like a cool project. Christopher, thanks a lot for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
That was Christopher Pitts, a Wisconsin-based photographer, the owner of Christopher Pitts Photography, LLC. And he was with us there to talk about his Devil's Lake photo project for Street View from Google Maps. And we've got links up on the Central Time Facebook page if you'd like to take the virtual tour of Devil's Lake and beyond.
And it is a lot of fun with that Devil's Lake one to spin around and be like, yeah, I've stood right there. And you get a taste of that without leaving the office.
Coming up, our guest looks at the future of scientific research under the Trump administration. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrat. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Storytelling with a Beat on Snap Judgment. Tonight's theme is mirrors. You can run and hide from just about everyone except yourself. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, as the White House transitions from one administration to the next, some scientists are concerned about the future of science under the new Trump administration. In general, scientists are nonpartisan actors on the policy stage, but that doesn't mean they won't advocate for the value of science.
In recent days, there's talk among the scientific community about a possible march on Washington, and there's concern among some scientists about the politicization of climate change data, the future of fact-based decision-making, and possible roadblocks to international cooperation.
Celeste Rolfing joins us now. She's the Chief Operating Officer of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Celeste, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to join you today.
Well, obviously, you can't speak for the American scientific community as if it were a monolith, but what is your overall sense of how science will be valued and applied under the new Trump administration?
Well, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, just for your listeners, is the world's largest general membership society in science, and we represent over 100,000 members plus through affiliates. And we've been very active in following all the developments with the Trump administration and during this transition.
And what is your sense about how it's going to be going forward?
So there is definitely a high sense of anxiety in the scientific community, but we urge restraint and calm at this point. There are often early missteps in a transition from one administration to another, especially when there's a changeover in the party that's in charge. And we are watching everything very closely, and we have a lot of information on our website to help scientists learn how to advocate for science.
Did you see a similar sense of anxiety when the administration was switching over from George W. Bush to Barack Obama?
Yes, I did. At that time, I was not with the American Association for the Advancement of Science. I was working with the federal government, but yes. And prior to that, the switch over from Clinton to Bush.
Now, some scientists today are concerned about the future of climate change research. President Trump himself has tweeted about this issue. He's called it bad for business and a hoax at various times in various years. What future do you see for climate change research?
Well, definitely the President Trump has had a mixed record on how he feels about climate change in his remarks over the years. However, I think there is a good reason to believe for a different reaction from the administration nominees. In all of their testimony to date, all of the nominees have talked about climate change not being a hoax, in fact, it being real, indisputable. There is certainly dissension by the nominees as to how much this is due to greenhouse gases and other effects, but people are, at least the administration officials, do recognize climate change as real.
Now, your organization has found it necessary to respond to a couple of the news items that have emerged in these at least first few days, about 10 days or so. Mm-hmm. And early on in the transition, there was news that the Trump administration was halting communication from both the EPA and the USDA, and you responded to that. What is your stance?
So, none of these decisions right now are permanent. It is not uncommon in a transition for there to be a lull in communications, either between either missteps by incoming officials or by overly zealous people within agencies. So we are watching this very closely. We feel very strongly about open communication of government scientists with the rest of the scientific community and the public. Indeed, we are watching it closely.
Now, in a Washington Post article, the head of your agency used the word concern at this news story. Is that fair to characterize?
Oh, yes, we are definitely concerned. And again, we do not see any evidence yet of any sort of permanent ban on communication, at which point we would move into a very different space. Yes.
Right now, we are talking with Celeste Rolfing, Chief Operating Officer of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And she's with us to talk about possible emerging concerns about the role of science and research in the coming years. Mm-hmm. And how would you like organizations like yours, in an ideal world as you see it, to help inform policy that affects them, things like immigration policy?
So I think that as an association and a membership society, we would encourage, and we do encourage, all of our members to reach out to their elected officials at the local, state, and federal levels. And members of Congress in particular listen to people in their districts, in their universities that are in their districts, the research facilities in their districts, and the companies in their districts. And scientists and the public need to make a special effort to reach out to lawmakers who have a history of backing science. And in general, scientists have to be vigilant against false information and evidence-free arguments.
False information and evidence-free arguments. Are you seeing any of that? I mean, we had the recent alternative facts from Kellyanne Conway that has caused some concern. But do you think that's something that is of concern right now to your organization?
So, yes, in the sense that we want to make sure that developing policy is based on the best available evidence. We haven't seen policy yet. We haven't seen laws or bills yet, but we are watching it closely.
Do you feel like the channels of communication are open? Again, the head of your organization, Rush Holt, heavily quoted in an article from the Washington Post, and the gist of the article that some key figures from the world of science, like your organization, are having a hard time opening channels of communication with the Trump administration. Do you still feel like that's the case?
Yeah, I think things are better now that we're especially getting nominees. Now that Congress is actually Senate is actually confirming nominees, I think we'll have much better luck getting into the administration and having those channels of communication. Again, it's not unusual in a time of transition like this, especially with the administration coming in that doesn't have a history of public service, to know how government actually works. So certainly it was a concern in the early days, but I think it's starting to open up.
Now, there's no date yet, but there's reportedly a scientist march on Washington that's in the planning stages. Do you think that's an appropriate move by the organizers and the would-be marchers, the people who might participate?
Yes. So, in fact, I learned today, I believe the date has been set for April 22nd in Washington, D.C., and possibly there might be satellite marches in other cities. So American Association for Advancement of Science has certainly been in touch with the organizers, and we're looking forward to additional information how we might be able to be involved in this activity.
So would this,
but it is a grassroots organization right now.
Would this be a political move? Would this be in protest of the Trump administration, or would this be a march, as you see it, that would be to advocate for maybe something more broad, like the value of science?
So the organization has gone through a lot of discussion on this, and my understanding right now, looking at their website, which was refreshed the other day, is that it's definitely a pro-science march. It is not an anti-Trump march.
If it were, would you still participate?
I can't speak for the organization itself. We would have to look very closely to make sure that whatever message is being delivered by that organization when they march is aligned with our own core values.
Now, there are some people who say that it's a maybe not a smart thing to do to have this march, that it politicizes science, and that's not what scientists want. Scientists want science to stay neutral so that the policy that can be applied by a Democrat or a Republican, and that it's taken on its own merit. Do you think that there's something to that concern?
Well, there is, but I think that you could have a march that's pro-science that is not politicized. It can talk about the need, again, for evidence-based policy. It can talk about, again, support for the federal agency and federal funding that goes to research and all the wonderful actions that have come out of high-quality scientific research that builds on our economy and our health.
We're talking with Celeste Rolfing right now, Chief Operating Officer of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and she's with us to talk about concerns about the role of science in the coming years.
We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How should scientific research be applied when it comes to government policy, federal policy? Do you see science as political or becoming politicized? What do you think is at stake for scientists in the coming years? Do you see value in federal funding, public funding of scientific research? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation now with Celeste Rolfing. She's the Chief Operating Officer of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And she's with us to talk about concerns about the role of science and scientific research under the new Trump administration.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see as the role for scientific research in public policy, whether that's on climate change or maybe less controversial issues from agriculture to economic development? Do you see science as political or being politicized? What do you think of the idea of a march in favor of science in the planning stages for a couple of months from now in the nation's capital? Good idea. Do you work in the sciences? What do you think about all of this? What's at stake? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Celeste, going forward, how would you articulate the value of federally funded research to the new administration?
So there's a very long history of our country's investment in federally funded research with very practical applications, as well as just the thrill of advancing human knowledge and reaching out to other worlds through space program.
And do you think that that's something that will continue in terms of the funding? Is that something of concern, or is it always a concern with every president, how much federal money will go toward research?
Yes, that's a concern no matter what the administration is and what the Congress is going forward. So, again, something we closely monitor. We publish an analysis online immediately after there's a release of a federal budget, be it the president's budget request or what Congress actually enacts and passes into law through appropriations. So we look very carefully at that and how it might affect different agencies differently. I believe the biggest concern, I think, right now would be any kind of flat reduction across the board cut without a strategic approach as to where those cuts would be.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Nathan on the line in Northern Illinois. Nathan, thanks for joining us.
Hi. So I'm a little background on me real quick. I am working with the organizers of the recently established March for Science, and I'm also head moderator of Reddit's Our Science. So I touch a lot of angles and views of science in the community. I feel like I'm pretty in touch with the scientific community. And I can tell you that this recent March for Science is more against the politicization of science and not really about trying to push a political view onto science. There's a lot of scientists who have a lot of different political views, but the one thing we all agree on is data-driven discovery and decision-making. And when we see the federal government come in and force political ideology onto funding and representation of science, we get very worried, because we recognize that science is the basis of innovation in this country, and innovation is the basis of development and job creation. So if we really want a successful United States, we need to continue to fund science, and that funding needs to be not dependent on political whims. This goes as far as immigration status, too, because what's maybe not particularly known in the general public is the United States attracts the best and the brightest of the world. They come here to work in our scientific fields. They set up scientific startups and companies, and they hire Americans because this country is where you come to do science. And if we turn our back on science funding and science is a free exercise, we turn our back on really the future and the future of job prospects for all of us.
Nathan, thank you for that. And early on when you spoke, you said the march was against the politicization of science. Can you point to an example of what you're talking about?
Well, we're currently working on coming out with our mission statement and getting our message clarified. But as you'll see in the coming weeks, we're not taking a partisan bent. In fact, we're specifically taking a nonpartisan bent. You know, it's a big tent message. There are many different scientists with many different views, and the message hasn't been as clear yet because it's a week old. We're still getting organized and getting the message out there. But you will see that the message is science is not a partisan issue. Science is the basis of our country's greatness.
Nathan, thank you for that and appreciate that call. Celeste, what do you say to Nathan's goals there and how he spoke about the march?
I couldn't have said it any better, and I appreciate him calling in and supplying more information about the march.
Nathan, thank you so much for calling there. And in terms of other news stories relating to science that have emerged in about the past 10 days, President Trump met with vaccine skeptic Robert Kennedy Jr., and the scientific community widely considers connections between vaccines and autism as disproven. Do you see a meeting like that as an indicator of a new administration's attitude, or how do you read a meeting like that?
So that was interesting when that occurred. We obviously came out with the information about, again, there is no link between the vaccines and autism. Those early studies have since been discredited by further work by scientists on this. There, I believe, has been no follow-up from that meeting between Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Trump. So there hasn't been any announcement about having any kind of commission to open up this subject again.
Let's take another caller. We've got Gavin with us in Madison. Gavin, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks a lot for taking my call. I was wondering if you knew anything about, I just looked it up, Senate Bill 103 called the Local Zoning Decisions Protection Act. It was sponsored by Senator Mike Lee of Utah, and it was basically prohibiting federal funding from going toward the collection of any data about racial disparities in the housing market. I was kind of curious to know if you knew anything about that, because I see that as something that is a kind of assault on collecting data about something that we know is an issue, which is racial disparities in housing. I mean, I think that's exactly what the federal government needs to be keeping its eye on, because states and localities sometimes aren't incentivized to do that. So I'm just kind of curious to know your thoughts on that, or if you know anything about it.
Gavin, thank you. Celeste?
Actually, I don't know anything about that, so I can't speak to it, but I will follow up myself after we're done on the phone here.
All right, Gavin, thank you. And Celeste, earlier Nathan, our first caller, talked also about, he touched on immigration legislation. He didn't necessarily reference it like that, but we've seen this new immigration and refugee executive order, which has alarmed some scientists who say that this discourages the free flow of information and open borders. He said the best and the brightest come to the United States to practice science, a concern about that status. What is the stance right now of your organization when it comes to that executive order?
Thanks. Yes, we have come out with a statement requesting a rescinding of that executive order. We joined together in a multi-society, multi-university effort and released our statement approximately 24 hours ago. We have, at the last I checked, we had about 160 organizations signed on, but we are actually growing more and more every day. This order definitely threatens to diminish the attractiveness of the U.S. as a destination for scientific researchers. It discourages international students from coming to the U.S. to pursue their education here. It's going to work against scientists who want to attend academic and scientific conferences, which are very important for the communication and flow between scientists and the progress of science in general. It may discourage people coming here to build new businesses in the U.S.
And you said you would like to see the entire executive order rescinded, all of it.
That is correct.
And any word about whether there'll be more action taken? You're gathering signatures. Any more action planned?
So at this point, we have just worked with a large number of, you know, over 160 organizations to sign on to a letter requesting this. But I have no more information about where there will be, if that will have any effect on the immigration ban. Fortunately, we could say that the ban is temporary at this point. It is a temporary ban. It's unfortunate that it's happening even at all. There will obviously be a greater and stronger reaction if any of this is put into place for a longer term.
Let's take another caller now. We have Ryan with us in Menominee. Ryan, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to share?
Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to draw out this intersectionality between what we're talking about and educators have been facing for a few years here, where there's been a fight, for lack of a better term, between state administration and public schools on teaching science and on funding research. And I hesitate to stay positive, but I feel like if these orders issued by Trump can be blocked, that there's a positive spin on this new viewpoint on the importance of the sciences and on education in sciences.
Ryan, I'm sorry, you cut out for a couple key words there. You're saying you were talking about education, and could you flesh that out just briefly so we can get the gist of it?
Sure. That education in Wisconsin has been a key issue against state administration. So it's just interesting to see these parallels that now more people can focus on funding of the sciences at a federal level, but that'll also draw attention to the state level as well.
Okay, Ryan, thank you. I think we got you there. And Celeste, just briefly, how would you respond to what Ryan's getting at there?
I didn't actually hear all of it again with some cutting out of there, but obviously we also care very much at our organization about the funding of education, especially with respect to science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, the will be so-called STEM disciplines.
And we leave it there. Celeste, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Okay, my pleasure.
That was Celeste Rolfing, the Chief Operating Officer of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and she joined us to talk about the outlook for scientific research going forward under the new Trump administration. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.